Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Amelia Earhart. She represents one of the last remaining mysteries of our modern era. As she attempted to fly around the world, her plane was lost at sea, and speculation has persisted for over 75 years as to what exactly happened. The question now stands, how have we still not found one of our world's most charismatic and inspirational women?
My name's Dana Timmer. I led the first ever deep water sonar search for Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra, and I'm on the verge of discovering what really happened to her all those years ago. For the past 15 years, I've been double-checking the data, meeting with experts, and piecing together the final moments of Amelia's approach into Howland Island.
We're here with you now, confident of our data, that we know where the airplane is at the bottom of the Pacific. It's with this data that we've built an extensive support group, including the 99s, which is a women's aviator collective Amelia originally founded.
I'm excited about this expedition to find Amelia's plane, because my generation of female pilots, we exist because of her legacy. And this is our chance to connect with the spirit that inspires our success.
But it's not just the 99s. It's going to take cutting-edge sonar equipment, which is why we're working with Williamson & Associates, leaders in their field of deep water searching.
My name is Mike Williamson. I'm a marine geophysicist and have been working with Dana Timmer for 15 years on the Amelia project. We have the technology today to actually solve the mystery and find the airplane.
And this solved the mystery of what really happened to Amelia.
Considered by many to be a purist when it comes to locating Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra 10E, project guest Dana Timmer has been an advocate for the ditch and sink hypothesis since he started investigating the events that occurred on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937. Working with and earning the professional respect of many of the world's premier experts in nautical exploration, Dana led the very first deep water search for Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, and their Lockheed Electra 10E in 1999, and he's been feverishly working this case ever since. Working with the team of Michael Williamson and Arthur Wright at Williamson & Associates, Dana believes that it's just a matter of when for the location and retrieval of the Holy Grail of aviation. Tonight, on the 68th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Dana joins us via Zoom from Vienna, Austria, along with Mike Williamson and Arthur Wright joining us from Seattle, Washington, to discuss Expedition Amelia and why they collectively believe that the interest in this case is high, the technology is there, and the time to end Amelia's story is now.
Joining me tonight is a guest that I have personally been trying to get on the show for almost a year now. He's considered by many to be a purist when it comes to locating and recovering Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra, and his work is respected by many of the top minds in nautical exploration. It's been a long time coming, but Mr. Dana Timmer, welcome to Chasing Earhart, sir.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Now, usually we have only a single guest on each respective episode of the show, but tonight's going to be a little different because tonight Dana brought some friends with him, and it's my honor to welcome to this conversation tonight Arthur Wright and Mike Williamson. Mike has over 40 years of experience in the marine geophysics and acoustics industry, and Art is considered by many to be one of the minds when it comes to underwater sonar, and it's a pleasure to have their technical expertise to add to this conversation that we're about to have. Mike and Art, welcome to Chasing Earhart, gentlemen.
Glad to be here.
So, first things first, before we dive in here, no pun intended, let's do some housekeeping, and we'll start with Dana. Dana, can you give everyone listening a little bit on your education, your professional background, please?
Sure. I grew up in Santa Barbara and started sailing at a young age, went to the University of Arizona in the business and public administration field. After I got out of college, I did a little bit of work for the United States Geological Survey. They were doing some surveys on the up and down the California coast. Then it's a little bit of work in the offshore oil field business, also in Santa Barbara. And then I got into the professional sailing world, America's Cups and that kind of stuff. So that's it in a nutshell.
And Mike, we'll have you up next. What about you?
Okay, well, after a degree in geology, I was in the Navy as a diving and salvage officer. And on completion of that, I wanted to put the geology and the underwater work together and went to grad school in geological oceanography, marine geophysics. And it's been a wild ride ever since.
And Mr. Wright, last but not least, how about a little bit about your education, your professional background?
I from a Navy family, so I always wanted to go in the Navy. I graduated from Naval Academy. First ship was Destroyer. I was very familiar with their anti-submarine warfare sonars, went to sonar school. I went on in the Navy with minesweepers, finding mines, small objects on the bottom with sonars. Navy sent me to school for a master's degree in underwater physics. I retired from the Navy in 1985, found Mike, and we've been having fun ever since.
And now the next bit of housekeeping is going to bring us to our subject tonight, who is Amelia Earhart. Let's talk about early influence and professional influence. Dana, what is your earliest recollection of Amelia Earhart, and when do you remember her coming into your life professionally?
Hard to say when Amelia first came into my life. It would have been grade school at some point, but I don't know exactly when. I've been fascinated by the 1930s. It was a really, in spite of the Depression, a really rich time in so many fields, art, aviation, architecture. And so Amelia's name would have come up from time to time. I read William Manchester's book, The Glory and the Dream, in the early 70s, and he had some thoughts on Amelia, primarily that she was, the Japanese Saipan theory. So, I don't know, off and on, just hearing the name Amelia, but it wasn't until, I was sailing in the America's Cup in 1983 in Newport, Rhode Island, and saw an article in the local paper, the Providence Journal, about this researcher that had a theory about where the plane was. And it's just something I cut out of the paper and put away. And then it was 1993. I was reading Doris Rich's book about Amelia. And remember that little newspaper clipping and miraculously found it after 10 years. And I thought, well, if I am ever going to do anything about this, I should go meet this person. And that, of course, was Elgin Wong. On March 19, 1993, I had built an airplane, and I flew up to San Jose and met Elgin and Marie Long. And that's when I really got started down this path of, trying to find this airplane.
Now, Art, how about you? Do you remember any early recollections of Amelia when you were younger, and when did she come into your professional life?
When I was a kid, my family lived in Washington, D.C., and I would go to the Smithsonian, and they had an Amelia exhibit there. So I remember that, and then didn't think much about it until Elgin and Dana walked in our office one day in 1993 also, I believe, maybe 94.
And that's a perfect segue to Mike. So when Elgin and Marie walked into your office, I mean, that must have been the first professional, I guess, the inception of the professional work you've done on Amelia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, my mother was a Navy pilot in World War II and was influenced by Amelia. And she made a point of dragging me into the Amelia Earhart Smithsonian display. And so I guess that lodged it in the back of my head. But then my wife's family and their next door neighbor and best friend, John White and his son, were both pilots, captains for Flying Tigers, and Elgin Long was also a Flying Tiger pilot. The Whites knew of our company and finding airplanes and ships and missile parts and so forth in deep water, and mentioned us to them, to Elgin. And then Elgin and Marie just gave us a call and showed up at her office, and we started getting excited about a search plan. And then a couple of years later, Elgin showed up in Seattle with Dana in tow, and kind of went from there.
And that brings us full circle. Now, Dana, it seems by our research that your group, specifically, and then, of course, Nauticos and Earhart researcher Elgin Long, which we've been talking about so far, it all has an interesting kind of intertwining story and history, and I think it's important to start with that. Can you break down sort of the history of how the deep ocean searches have gone down when it comes to Nauticos, Elgin, and your group?
Well, there's also Ted Waite's search as well. And Alan Eustace did the last one last year. So there are a variety of people that have been out in the deep water. And well, like Mike pointed out, 1994 is when Elton and I went up and discussed this project with Art and Mike and his team. And so I was working with Elgin from 94 on to in 1998. You know, we were having a tough time raising all the funds and actually getting out of the water. And in 1998 is when Elgin decided to try his luck with Nauticos. And so he went off and pursued that avenue. And I continued my efforts with Art and Mike and a fellow named Guy Zions, who's part of our team. And we actually were the first out there in 1999. So that was the first ever deep water search for the plane. And then subsequently, there's, I don't know, been, what is it, four more since then. And so that's the early history anyway.
Now, Mike, when Dana comes to you initially to enlist your assistance, what's your first reaction to that? I mean, because so many people, as Dana alluded to, so many people have thrown their hats into the Earhart search at this point, even really then. But can you talk about what your first reaction was initially to that? Was it something that you were excited to tackle? Was it something that you thought might have been very difficult to tackle?
Well, we like challenges. And after extensive discussions with Elgin and his theories and with Dana, we thought we had a pretty good line on what led up to the loss of the airplane. And it made a pretty good story and basis of a search plan. And we started working on that. And then earlier in 1999, we found the Israeli submarine Dakar in deep water. And there was a lot of international publicity for that. And I think that really gave a kick to getting some funding to go out for Amelia. It developed from there. Art did a search plan that was based on the factual evidence that was available and the scenarios that made the most sense that had been run by a number of experts, third-party experts, and thought we had a pretty good program. And when Dana got the funding together, we were ready to go. Pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I imagine. Now, Art, so many groups have employed the use of multiple types of underwater sonar in their respective searches for Earhart and the Lockheed Electra. But for the young folks that are listening out here, because we have a lot of like 15, 16-year-olds that are listening to the show or that will listen to the show, I wonder if you can explain the role that underwater sonar plays in a search like this.
I need to refer to Mike on that one because he built the sonar. And it was his sonar and the first commercial deep-towed sonar in the world.
Well, in an earlier stint with in ocean mining after graduate school, we developed a sonar to find manganese nodules on the deep sea floor and used a 30 kilohertz sonar because it had a resonance, a wavelength that resonated with the actual size of nodules on the seafloor and gave an enhanced backscatter. And it turned out that that same resonance was also ideal for distinguishing man-made objects, metal and so forth, from rocks and so forth on the seabed. And high-resolution deep-water sonar that a capability that hadn't been around before. And we had quite a bit of success from its inception in 93 and continuing to evolve the system. And we still are basically the proponents of that frequency, and nobody else seems to be using it, but it's been very successful, and we think it's the tool for Amelia Earhart's airplane.
So, Dana, now I have a question that I've been saving for you, and I'd love to chat about it now. Now, earlier in the show, we had Chief Radio Man of the Itasca, Leo Bellarts, on the show in a three-part interview, and we spoke with Leo at length regarding the events of that day, the morning of July the 2nd, 1937. He said something that struck me as odd, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. He mentioned that the Itasca was consistently recording signal strength fives from Earhart and Noonan, yet when he stepped outside the radio booth, he neither saw nor heard her anywhere on the horizon. Secondly, there has been a lot of debate as to the cloud cover that morning, and coming from someone that was actually there that day, Leo says, quote, no cloud cover whatsoever. So I wanted to collect your thoughts on that.
Well, you can easily get a S5 radio signal in the radio room and step outside and not be able to hear or see an airplane, I don't know, 10, 15, 18 miles away. You just wouldn't. And remember, the wind is going from east to west, so the sound would be being carried away from the Itasca. And so there's nothing unusual about getting a really loud signal strength in the radio room and not being able to go outside and actually see or hear the airplane. The weather, as you know, is a very dynamic thing. And so there wasn't any cloud at the Itasca at Howland. As Amelia was approaching a couple hundred miles out, she could have had some. But remember, she's coming out of the darkness. So she's going from, you know, dark to low light to, you know, the sun coming up. And she would have been up at altitude, 8,000, 10,000, whatever she was at that point. You know, in the early light, the occlusion would have looked probably a lot more severe than it probably was. In hindsight, she probably did not need to go down to 1,000 feet. As the day got brighter, she would have seen that those clouds were not as dense as she would have thought under a low light situation.
Yeah, now just to give people an idea, because it's been talked about a lot, and not only within Chasing Earhart, but just with every Amelia Earhart project that's ever been done. Dana, can we give people an idea of how close Amelia and Fred would have had to have gotten to Howland Island to be able to get a visual that morning?
Well, remember, she's looking directly into the rising sun, so you basically can't see anything. And I know Art has some thoughts on this with, Mr. Kammerer, who was interested in doing a search at one time. But Art, why don't you discuss that for a moment?
Yeah, Mike Kammerer in 2003 rented a helicopter and went into the island from the west on that day in July, and he could not see the island until he got within 8 miles, just due to early in the morning. Given that information, I have revised my thoughts on how close to the island Amelia actually got.
Now, Mike, when you take on a case like this, a case that's over 81 years old now, it has so many different groups investigated from different hypotheses and different standpoints. Do you have to ask yourself sort of what you can bring to the table that hasn't been previously brought?
Well, yeah. It's basically a search is based on the laws of physics. So you have to evaluate all of the different theories and apply some sort of measuring stick, put error bars around each fact or conjecture about leading up to the loss, to determine the lost datum and then the size of the area that must be searched. And if you do this in a pretty rigorous manner, the results are based on science rather conjecture. And so far in 35 years, it's been a pretty good formula. It's led us to many successful searches for small targets in deep water. Now this is treated just the same as it has been for other similar targets.
Now, Art, we had Andy Sherrill on the show a while back, and we discussed on that episode his work with the Waite Foundation and using underwater AUVs in the search, in their particular search. If this plane is in the neighborhood of Howland, it could be resting at depths of almost 18,000 feet below the surface. Now, when you utilize sonar at these levels, does that change the game when it comes to the location of a craft that's this small?
That's a large airplane, the Electra, and our pulse width is 2.5 meters at a 6,000-meter scale. And anything on that plane, the tires, the radial engines, any small circular metallic part is going to have an enhanced signal. And that'll be across several pixels, and it stands out like a sore thumb. So no, the 30 kilohertz, which by the way is the same frequency the Navy uses in mine hunting, very similar, enhances the signal. Whereas on the higher frequencies, like 100, 150, 300 that the other companies use, a metal piece looks like a rock. And that's a big difficulty in a search. for small objects, distinguishing between geology and man-made objects. With 30 kilohertz sonar, it's much easier.
Now, I want to ask all three of you a question because I'd like to collect the thoughts of the group here. Now, we've talked a lot about Occam's Razor throughout this project, and for those that are listening and don't know, essentially Occam's Razor states in part that the simplest of competing theories is preferred to the more complex. And the theory that requires less, you know, well, this might have happened and this might have happened and this might have happened, should be considered as fact, and that's indeed what the United States government stands behind to this day. Now, we've talked a lot about radio signal issues, miscommunication, potentially bad weather, potentially bad planning. My question for the group is the explanation here that a million little things just went wrong and a million Fred just had a really bad day at the worst possible time? And Dana, you can start with this if you'd like.
Regardless of what theory you're operating under, you know, whether it's the Saipan or the, you know, any of them, the only hard evidence we have are the Itasca logs. What Amelia was saying and the relative signal strengths of those signals. And the operators in the Itasca were very skilled at determining, you know, what is S2. S1 is low, S5 is the highest, loud and clear. And so that's what we need to focus on, are those radio signal strengths and what Amelia was saying. And so, you know, just to go through it very briefly, you know, 614, 0614, early morning. Amelia says she's 200 miles out. That position would have been from Fred Noonan's star site that he had gotten, you know, about an hour roughly before, the last star site he did. You could take that to the bank. They were about 200 miles out. They already started asking for a bearing at that time. 0645, about 100 miles out. That, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that because they couldn't have gone a 100 miles in a half an hour. But Amelia was not trying to give a definitive position. She was trying to establish radio contact. And so, you know, she, just in her mind, she, that was not Fred's position. That was just something Amelia, you know, a half an hour ago, 200, you know, instead of saying 118 point whatever you would do today with a GPS, she just said about 100 miles out, also asking for a bearing. Then at 0742, we should be on you. The gas is running low. This is the first sign of distress. She didn't have any problems or distress in the previous messages. And we know the signals are getting stronger with each one. 645 is stronger than 614. 742 is stronger than 645. And at 758, circling. So now she's, you know, they should have seen the island, at least seen it or been on it at 742. And now, you know, almost 15 minutes later, she's trying to, you know, there's something's wrong here. So she's circling. When in fact, if they had kept doing what they were doing, which is flying straight into the island on a course of something like 076, you know, very easterly course, they had kept on it another 10 to 15 minutes, they would have seen the island. But they lost it at 0742. Now they're not focusing at where the island is straight ahead, but, you know, is it to the left, to the right? Where I differ from the other celestial navigators, meaning Elgin Long and Gary LePoop and Roy Nesbitt, I spent a lot of time with him. He was an English RAF navigator in World War II, very knowledgeable guy. We spent a lot of time together at the RAF Club in London, Royal Air Force Club, going over celestial, the navigation. Any case, circling. Then at just a couple of minutes later, she's going off the schedule. She started a search. Now, the celestial navigators I just mentioned have her deliberately offsetting one side or the other of a Howland. And then you have to advance your position far enough and then fly down. That's where the 157 or the 337 line comes in. But they didn't do that. I know that this is not going to go over well with the astronavs that I just mentioned, but they never did that offset approach. And they flew straight into the island They were short at 7:42, thought they should be there 8 o'clock. We must have missed it. And then the last transmission at 8:45 is we're flying north and south on the 157-337 line. And so it's, and south is very critical. I know some people want to say north, some people want to say south, but she said, and this was in the Itasca log, flying north and south. So she was in a search pattern after missing the island. This it's sometimes called the Chichester line of approach, that deliberate offset to one side or the other of the island. That will help you with any north-south error, but it doesn't do anything for your east and west error.
All right, so Dana, we've talked a little bit about Morse code throughout the project as well. I know it's speculative, but can you tell me a little bit about that? Do you think if they would have been properly trained in Morse code, Amelia and Fred, speaking of them, that we'd be having a totally different conversation right now, historically speaking?
Oh, I think there's a good chance that that is correct. Yeah, I mean, it's Morse code would have been a very good skill to have for either Amelia or Fred. They were, you know, the Itasca was sending out A's, you know, just the letter A, just so they would have something to home in on. One thing that's important is if Amelia was coming in from the north on that, you know, coming down the 157 line, she would have said something at either, you know, 0742 or right around there. I don't know if your listeners know how an RDF works. You know, there aren't very many of them around anymore, but you need a DR. You need to know roughly where the signal is coming from. And so it's not, you don't just, the RDF antenna is that little loop on top of the cockpit of the Electra. You don't just turn these things around and around and around 360 degrees. You are looking in a quadrant. And the Itasca would have been expecting Amelia from the west, not from the north. I'm sure that was not communicated, this line of approach procedure, to the Itasca. So, you know, the lack of her saying something, you know, inbound from the north, something to that effect, tells me that they did not do that. One of the reasons that I don't think they came in on that line of approach procedure, but rather flew straight in and then got in too late to ever go off one side or the other and perform that approach.
Now, another question for Mike and for Art. Now, we have this 39 and a half foot roughly plane in the middle of the ocean. It's no easy task to find it. When we had Tom Benson on the show from Rockwell Collins, he had mentioned that the most difficult aspect of for their team, and I think for any team looking at the ocean for this plane, is just where to start looking, where to start finding it. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of the search? How do you pick a spot to start looking for it? How do you narrow this ocean down?
You have a probability area that you think she's in. You have a 45-day mission, and you're going to have 30 days on station, just given the logistics, fuel, and food for the boat. So you take that 30 days, say, and you put tracks in there. In our case, we use 2,500-meter line spacing, overlapping tracks with a 6,000-meter swath. You can see that we cover everything twice, and we mow the lawn in that area. And any target is going to show up. It can't hide. And you're going to get a close look at it and a far look at it. The way we have a beam pattern and a far look, one small point target stretches out with very high, dark return, as opposed to rocks, which have a slightly lighter return. That's a steel target. Just stands out like a sore thumb. People who are trained in looking at 30 kilohertz sonar data recognize that immediately. So you have very high confidence in what you're doing. And you just go mow the lawn. And if you do get a good target, you log it in and come back on next track. And if it shows up again, you know you got something. And then you bring in your range. If you cut your range from a 6,000 meter swath to a 3,000 meter swath, you've just doubled your resolution. So you get a better look at it. And you go back on a higher resolution, better look at the target. You find out more details about the target. And then you come in on a 1,500 meter swath. We've done this search many, many times. And we found, you know, the submarine Grunion we found in 2 weeks the Dakar we found in about 2 weeks, the Australian cruiser hospital ship about 2 weeks. We've had good luck with it.
2 weeks seems to be the magical number. And I love that term, mowing the lawn, by the way. That makes it really easy for, I think, young people that are listening to this to understand, because everybody's mowed a lawn, I think, at some point. Let's talk about preservation, Mike. If indeed the flying laboratory sits at the bottom of the ocean, can you give us all an idea of what kind of condition that we could expect to find it in once you locate it?
Those water depths, if you get below 3,000 meters, the ocean is undersaturated in calcium carbonate, called the CCD, the calcium carbonate depth of dissolution. So that means that any bone fragments and that sort of thing that might be associated with the remains of Amelia and Fred would have totally been dissolved in a fairly short period of time. So there's not going to be anything that would allow DNA evidence to be analyzed and so forth. The human remains would all be gone. And that makes it a little different than shallow water wrecks that have been, they've recovered bone fragments to identify airmen missing in action from World War II and so forth. That wouldn't be possible there. But certainly the aircraft would be largely intact. Those big radial engines are going to be big radial engines. They're not going to have broken into little pieces. The airframe was pretty stout, so we'd expect that there to be big pieces, and if not an aircraft that was intact.
Dana, did you have a question about that, or do you have something to add to that?
Yes, a couple of things. Both Art and Mike know from all their experience that things retrieved out of the deep ocean, certainly from the Titanic, are remarkably in good condition. They brought up a violin from the Titanic, clothes, newspapers, still readable. Recently, a camera was found in a World War II trench, and it belonged to a Soviet soldier. Remarkably, that camera, they were able to develop one of the photos. This camera has been in a ditch, in mud and water, and for the last 77 years, they were able to develop one of the shots that was on that roll of film. So the deep ocean is a great place to preserve something, really, remarkably. And so I think we'll find the airplane pretty well intact. I think Amelia probably did a reasonable job of ditching it, and then it would have sank relatively soon after being on the water. And it's down there in the vicinity of Holland, I think it'll be an amazing time capsule of what happened during this flight. Fred's charts will bear out, I think, what I've been trying to tell you as far as the final hours here in the sequence of events leading up to this disaster. So, things are well preserved in the deep ocean.
So Amelia's mother, Amy Otis, who we're going to have on the show in the coming weeks, actually is an icon episode. She had an interesting approach to the disappearance of her daughter, and initially she was on board with when it came to crash and sink or dish and sink, but then she changed her mind and firmly believed that Amelia was indeed in the hands of the Japanese and ultimately died in their custody. And I wanted to know if you had ever looked into that, and just, I guess, collect your personal thoughts on that particular aspect of it.
Well, maybe it was wishful thinking on her part to hope that they had actually landed somewhere, and if you put it down somewhere, that changed her mind. I know Mr. Putnam was doing a lot of behind the scenes work with the government, the Navy, the Coast Guard, to try to pursue every avenue of finding Amelia and Fred. So maybe something there, triggered that change of heart, so to speak. But I've never seen anything that has been convincing, that has convinced me of any of the other theories. If Amelia had miraculously found a known from an unknown, obviously they didn't know where they were. They would have found Holland. Then, and say, for example, flown 300 miles to the south and landed on an atoll. There's a very nice hard-packed sand runway at low tide on the island. That is where you would have put the plane down, not on a reef. You would have ripped the landing gear off. Certainly, if you were to be able to put the plane down on the reef without ripping the landing gear off and make a successful landing, then you would have been able to slowly taxi the plane up to the high water mark, wait for, you know, help. Theoretically should have been able to take off again and complete the flight. So I've never seen anything in any of the, all the variety of theories that has convinced me that anything other than ditching and sinking near Howland Island as it was the fate of that flight. So that's my take on it.
Now, of all the aspects of the final flight that's most talked about, bad navigation seems to be right at the head of the pack. You've talked a little bit about it in this episode tonight, but there are several folks that believe that Fred Noonan may have been suffering from exhaustion and therefore could have made mistakes that put them off course of their intended destination. What does your research tell you when it comes to that aspect?
Well, there's always an inherent error in celestial navigation. It could be very small, but, you know, it's not GPS. I don't think Fred made very much of an error at all. I think, there was obviously some. They were behind where they thought they were. And so, we know that from the, we should be on you at 0742. And then they continued to fly straight ahead towards the island. We know that because the signal strengths got stronger. So it was just very unlucky. They were looking into the rising sun. As Art pointed out, you couldn't even see the island from 8 miles, which is not a great error at all after a 2,556-mile flight. So they got very unlucky, but probably the downfall was the reason they missed the island is because of poor pre-flight planning, the radio and the times, the schedules. Amelia's on Greenwich Mean Time and the ship is on local time, which was oddly 11 and a half hours from Greenwich. So, out of sync on the radio work and off, in the schedule. And so, poor pre-flight planning between the Itasca and Amelia, which was done long distance primarily. So that really was the downfall. They needed that RDF bearing to get in and direct communication, in spite of Fred doing a very good job of getting them very close to the island.
There also is the aspect of the misplotting of the island at the time. During World War II, they discovered that Howland had been misplotted by something like 5 nautical miles further to the east, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when the visual range is only 8 miles to begin with, that plus flying into a headwind that they weren't aware of because they didn't have any way at night to know, from whitecaps and so forth on the water that they were bucking a headwind, it just added to the bad luck. They had no control over either one of those things that did have an effect on their estimated position.
And Chris, there's one more thing. There's some confusion around the, the Itasca was putting out smoke. And, in the log, it says it was 10 miles. Well, if you're the emitter, how do you measure 10 miles? We know that these soot particles are very heavy, so they tend to be pulled down by gravity rather quickly. A ship at station, and Art, you can probably comment on this as well, is not going to put out a 10-mile smoke trail. Possibly when it was steaming, up to the northwest after her last transmission with the right atmospheric conditions. But there's a picture of the Itasca putting out smoke that morning, and it's going nowhere. So there wasn't this big smoke trail to follow in. In hindsight, Amelia and Fred probably should have left 2 hours earlier, 0800 instead of 10 o'clock in the morning. They would have been closer to their last star sight, which is a lot more accurate than certainly a sunrise shot. And, because you get 3 stars and you get a fix as opposed to just one line.
Now, I want to go around the panel real quick and just ask, we only have a couple more questions here before we wrap up tonight, but I want to ask, because we asked this to everybody that's representing the crash and sink or crash and ditch hypothesis, I want to ask you guys what you think or what you would like to see happen to this plane once it was found and located. I mean, a lot of people have really great answers to this question, but let's say the plane hypothetically was pulled out of the water next week. What would you guys want to see happen to the plane? Mike, we'll start with you.
Certainly, you'd have to conserve it. Something coming up from the deep ocean that's been in equilibrium with the salinities and pressures associated with it. You want to be able to make sure that the materials aren't destroyed by being dewatered too rapidly. And so conservation is required, as is carried out with other wrecks. They take a lot of time and effort to bring them back into the new environment. And that would have to be done professionally. You can keep them in salt water until you can get them to a conservative facility that can do the proper desalinization and so forth. But should be able to have a reconstruction or cleanup of something that would be suitable for display in Smithsonian or someplace.
Art, do you agree with that? What would you like to see happen to this plane once it was safely excavated and taken care of? Would you want to see it end up in a place like the Smithsonian or maybe taken on tour or something for everybody to see? What do you think about that?
I think it should go on tour so many people as possible have the opportunity to look at it and then end up in the Smithsonian.
That's what I think as well. Now, Dana, any thoughts on that? What would you like to see personally, if especially if you're the one that finds it, you're responsible for this, what would you want to see? What would be your conditions for recovery and everything? What would you want to see happen to it?
Oh, the plane definitely should end up in the Smithsonian at some point. It's an American treasure, and that's where it belongs. The traveling display has been discussed, and that's a great way to bring it to a large audience. And so, the conservation would take part, I think, while the plane is being displayed, part of the exhibit, and then eventually the plane will end up in the Smithsonian. That would be my wish.
Yeah, I think that would be a powerful visual to see the Vega, which she was so, that's my personal favorite plane of hers, but the Vega alongside the Electra like that. I think that'd be a real powerful visual for children, I think. The last question I have for everybody tonight is about impact and legacy. If Chasing Earhart's about anything, it's about that. I want to ask everybody, and we'll go around the table, and I'll start with Dana. Why is it that so many people seem to care so much about this woman's fate, 81 years, and Fred's fate, of course, 81 years after they disappeared? What's the big deal about this? What does it mean to everybody, and what does it mean to you personally, do you think?
That's a good question. I've thought about it a bit, and I don't know what it keeps, but keeps her so at the forefront of popular lore. Maybe it's because the world's never been in more of a need for positive role models than it is right now. I think maybe there's this collective yearning for a noble idea, and Amelia certainly represented those. But, out of all the icons, and, I think Amelia's more well-known than possibly even Lindbergh. Amelia's just part of the psyche of the public, and she was a really positive role model and doing some amazing things, and certainly laying it all out there on the line. And the disappearance, the mystery of it, I think adds to the story. So it's hard to say exactly why she's so popular, but she is more so now than certainly in all the years I've been pursuing this. So it's a good question, and I'm not sure I have all the answers for that.
Mike, what do you think about that? Why do you think the world cares so much about this case in particular and about the fate of these two people?
Well, obviously she was a pioneer and on heroic proportions, but as a role model, she was a really impressive role model for women in particular and young girls. Just accomplishing something equivalent to, first footstep on the moon kind of thing with the relative technology at the time. I think for women and girls, an example such as Amelia is pretty important.
And Art, finally, what is your thoughts on that? Why do you think so many people seem to care so much about the fate of this woman all this time later?
It's a mystery. In her day, she was a darling of the press, and every time she flew, she got a great amount of coverage, and then she disappeared, and I mean, there have been, I think, almost 100 books written about her. Certainly, you take all the other great people you can think of, she's up there at the forefront in the number of books that have been written about her. It's a mystery. And so the world loves a mystery. And there we are.
Now, what is next for you guys, for your work, Dana, particularly on this? I know you guys did a great Kickstarter not too long ago, really beautifully put together. I want to know if you're planning on trying to get out and do a search on your own. What's next for Williamson and Associates when it comes to the case of Amelia Earhart?
Well, I'm always looking at opportunities to get back out there. You know, piggybacking on three things, really: a suitable ship, Williamson sonar, and the team to operate the equipment. And there are other projects that happen out in the Pacific. So it's so expensive to do this kind of thing. Like I said, I'm looking for opportunities to piggyback on other projects. So the gear might be somewhere out in the general vicinity, and would be able to pick up the ship and get this gear on board. So yeah, I'm always looking at opportunities to get back out there as soon as I can.
And Mike and Art, what about you guys? What is next for you guys? Are you, obviously I know you're open to participating in searches and going through this process. Can you talk a little bit about what's next for the future of Williamson and Associates?
Well, we certainly would like to do a successful Amelia search. It's been on my bucket list for a number of years. We're convinced that we've got the right approach, right equipment, and just unfortunately we don't have the financing to do this individually, but there's a great opportunity here to solve the mystery, and we love challenging projects. Our credo is, if it was easy, anybody could do it, so it fits in that category.
Now, Mike, where can folks follow you guys online? Do you guys have a website and everything that we can plug for the website, or for the show, rather?
Well, sure. Our website is www.wassoc.com, and a lot of our exploits are chronicled there.
All right, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure tonight. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast. I know just a little expedition. We did this once before, but there was a technical glitch, and so we had to get together again. I really appreciate you all taking the time to sit in on us on this podcast tonight, and we really appreciate it. So thank you all for joining me.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Crash and Sync retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarrus Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated, and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.